Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Christian, and this is the Ice Age Farmer broadcast. And I'm joined today by a very special guest, Allison McDowell. Allison is a mother and a dedicated researcher studying the working parts of the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, the global takeover of industries and public policies by the central banks, multinational corporations, big tech technocrats, and the billionaire-funded foundations. Allison, in my opinion, is uniquely capable of distilling the agendas at play, the actors involved, and the language that they use into real-world terms that we can all talk about and understand. I'm thrilled to welcome her today so that we can do just that, have a conversation about this total technocratic takeover of everything, not just food, but everything from the big picture, society as a whole, right down to our bodies and the microbiome within them. Certainly our children and our futures as well. So that's why this is a super important conversation. You can find Allison on YouTube, and also she blogs at wrenchinthegears.com. Before we begin, I do have to say, if you appreciate this broadcast, if you value this information, please help me keep the broadcast running. There's a few ways listed to do that at icehfarmer.com/support, and I very genuinely appreciate your help. Now, without further ado, Allison McDowell, welcome to the Ice Age Farmer broadcast.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's absolutely my pleasure. You do fantastic work, and I've been looking forward to our conversation. I really appreciate that we come from very different backgrounds and lines of inquiry, but our work has evolved to fundamentally the same conversation, which is that we are spreading the word about and fighting a holistic, technocratic, anti-human agenda. And the bottom line, just to sort of frame our conversation today, is that there is this agenda to take total surveillance and control over every aspect of our life and the world, the food we eat, what's in our bodies, our microbiome, how we raise our children, all of it. And it sounds crazy, but if we start using words like tracking and incentivizing good food for good health outcomes or social impact investing, right? Then it's really hard to understand, I think, for a lot of people, but it certainly is harder to argue against that. Biodigital convergence. So suddenly you're a visionary philanthropist. So I really appreciate you joining me today to, first of all, because I want to get more eyes on your work, wrenchinthegears.com. She is on Twitter at Philly852 and does somehow we both still have YouTube channels. Let's aim to really crush it today and get me banned finally. Yes, to joining me to have this important conversation about that agenda, where we are with it, the fact that there's a sense of immediacy, right? There are actually already World Food Programs doing tests of blockchain-based currencies at the refugee camps. Biden and the USDA is seeking to expand SNAP benefits, which of course speaks to the whole thing. It's all rolling together right now. We're leaping into this beast system. And so I want people to understand what that means. And so I'm thrilled you're here to help me explain that. You want to start just by sort of introducing yourself and your background and how you started looking at all this?
Right. So I'm based in Philadelphia, and I sort of describe myself as a mom and an independent researcher. So I work at an urban botanic garden that has a small agricultural component that is framed as really a healing program, like an earth-based soil growing program, really. And so I don't do that. That's not my primary focus of work, but I have been sort of on, a piece of land in a post-industrial urban landscape for a long time. And so I have both sort of a macro view and a micro view of some of these systems that are underway. And I actually just got into this with school closures in our city of Philadelphia, where an underfunded urban school district and Boston Consulting Group came in and they closed 23 schools and laid off thousands of teachers. And then I went from being sort of a naive, liberal, that's not fair, life had been fair. Well, then that's not right. And then realizing as I dug in and followed money and power that it was about much, much more than just public education. It was about controlling, as you said, all these different aspects. And a lot of it was my focus is around the weaponization of the social safety net and the ways in which my framing that coincided with my awakening around these systems of power was also understanding broader histories, including around, empire, right? Like the inland empire of the United States and what happened to indigenous people. So some of my framing of what's happening around food systems and control of people, I feel is very strongly connected to the dispossession that happened, you know, hundreds of years ago, when people were taken out of their natural food systems and their relationship to land in a non-globalized, you know, supply chain economy and in that way. So that was sort of my way in. It was about poverty management after the schools, and then it was about health management. And, you know, fundamentally, if you can control people's access to shelter and their access to food, you know, you can control huge numbers of people. And that's what, sort of where things are now.
Absolutely. And one of the things I liked, I saw you on Twitter say, I wish I could have, you know, learned about this and warned people about it without having to learn a completely new language. And that's part of the reason I said up front that when you dress it up with these weird phrases, impact investing and good health outcomes, it's, you know, I don't think people really understand that this is all about control. How did you start learning that language? And can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, mostly what... I do. So in Philadelphia, we're also the home of the University of Pennsylvania and other higher systems of higher education. And this entire program of looking at natural life, really. So human life is a huge piece, but also financializing nature and natural systems came out of Wharton, out of the business school at University of Pennsylvania. And the former president of the university, Judith Rodin, left to become the head of the Rockefeller Foundation. So she set up what has essentially become this game that runs on big data analytics. And when I was poking around in the education space, I kept bumping up against, like, not just venture capital, you know, there were venture capital firms and consulting firms that were interested in putting, like, computers in schools and all of these things. But it wasn't just that, like, making money off of devices or off of cloud computing. It was actually hedge funds. And I kept thinking, like, what do the hedge funds have to do? Like, why is it? It's not just, you know, as predatory maybe as, like, these tech companies were. It was the gambling part, right? Mm-hmm. And so once you started to understand that the way in which digital systems of surveillance, sensor networks feed signals intelligence, right? Intelligence about individual and social behaviors that would both feed into strategic decisions that are militarized decisions or financial market decisions. There are other, you know, many aspects of this. And both, you know, Michael Bloomberg, who I think is equally as dangerous and doesn't get nearly the billing as Bill Gates, you know, that was his background, is data analytics and controlling urban populations. So that was sort of how I came into it. And I just taught myself. I mean, literally my background is in art history and cultural landscapes. So like what I was trained to do was just read primary source material and then sort of synthesize it, right? Like that's sort of what the art part is that you look at things symbolically, right? And then I get presented with things. It's put right in front of me. And I'm like, oh, this is where this piece of the puzzle fits in. This is how these things come together. And I fortunately have a situation where I'm a bit outside it. Like my work doesn't depend on me not knowing it. And I would say for most people who are in a similar position, it's very hard to get out of bed every day if you have to go to a job that you realize is building the singularity, you know, a militarized singularity. So you just really don't want to know. You don't want to know. So really for me, it was looking at LinkedIn profiles, you know, watching 4 hours of the World Bank New America Blockchain Summit, you know, looking at their white papers, because they all tell you it's not actually hidden. If you have the time to read and you believe them, then it just they figure nobody would come into their space reading their stuff if they didn't go along with it. Mm-hmm. And so some of us are the outliers, right? That read it and go, wait, this is actually abominable, you know? And that's sort of where, I taught myself. And it's hard because people are like, it's so hard. And I'm like, I know, but like, I'm just a mom. I figured it out. If you're motivated enough, you will. But I'm working on a glossary. I promise. Like, that's the next thing. I have bits and pieces of a glossary, but I'm looking to update that.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Just a place where people can go and say, "What? Yeah, when I see these terms for the first time, how do I decode?" It is a different language, people who go to work at a very large company have that experience where on their first day they're like, "I don't know what people are talking about." There's all these new acronyms, all these systems and processes that are being described. It's the same thing that is true in this network of think tanks and big multinational companies when they talk about stakeholders and all these weird things. So yeah, a glossary is a fantastic idea. But people need to be motivated to look at that glossary and to have this conversation, because it is not just that those conversations are some academic, you know, futurist, sitting in an ivory tower somewhere saying, well, we could build this system, and wouldn't it be cool? It's like, these are actually agendas that are being implemented and executed on. Like you mentioned, the UN has already rolled out the blockchain digital currency for refugees. Right. So expand on that a little bit, just the fact that this is a real-time situation, the immediacy of all of these programs and terms that are being thrown around, being rolled out now.
Yeah. So I would say it really helped me because once you get the schema, like once you understand, you can have some basic decoding of the language and you know the playbook, you can apply the playbook across sectors, right? Mm-hmm. So my immersion experience was around schools, right? They wanted children on dashboards with devices and they wanted to separate them from their teachers. And because the teachers wouldn't enter as much data as a device could, and then that's what was going to run these markets. And so when I started to hear about, like, even in urban settings around food systems, oh, you know, for example, Comcast wanted to put Internet of Things water temperature sensors in our garden. And we're like, no, we don't do, like, we grow soil, actually. Like, that's, it's, you don't put, you know, and then a funder was like, well, you know, you could turn this all into hydroponics. I'm like, no, that's not the point. Like, the point is actually being connected on land in relationship amongst each other. And then I started thinking, and then I looked into, oh, Comcast, which is headquartered here in Philly, you have two giant skyscrapers and they're running all the education data, but they also are getting drones. They're doing drone agriculture. So essentially what farmers and plants and, you know, the various environmental elements of agricultural systems are exactly like a classroom. They're like, teachers, don't mess with those dirty children. They might have diseases or grow, you know, put them on a device or a tablet, and then you go over here, over there, and then watch them through your device. And I'm like, that's what they want to do to agricultural systems, whether it's plants or livestock. Like, you don't actually want to touch those messy things. Go put them over there, track them on the devices, which creates vast, you know, new revenue sources for the data companies, the cloud computing companies, the technology companies. Like, these are all verticals for them to profit from. But then both, ultimately on both sides, all of that data is getting thrown into this thing that they want to use to build the singularity, which was the piece I didn't have really until the last maybe 4 or 5 months, was the way in which they are literally mining life processes on this planet, both human and animal and plant and microbiome, to build a virtual replica that they can control. Like, if we think that they can control us in a totality in a blockchain-based material world, the digital twin version is going to be even more under their control. Mm-hmm. And that piece is kind of crazy to imagine, but I mean, that's literally what they're doing.
Absolutely. Yeah, let's highlight that a little bit more. This idea that you can hear it described as augmented reality, where they have, because of the Internet of Things, constantly reporting all the data in, they build this mirror. Sometimes they call it a twin. Right. Twinning your twin factory. And so once we learn, we put sensors in your factory. Like you said, they talk about it's the same basic principles, whether it's the children or the plants or your factory. We're going to divorce people from the process and install sensors to collect the data. The people can then step back and monitor for now. Later we'll have AI and it'll be a post-human situation completely. So what we're witnessing across all these sectors is the divorce of people from the land, from the children, from the manufacturing, all of these things. Where were we going with that? So they talk about in each of these situations, the twinning, that we're constructing that virtual reality, augmented reality structure that mirrors you. And more as we get better data and better algorithms, we'll be able to have predictive value and then tell you how to tweak that. And that's where, as you were saying, that's where it becomes not just a perfect surveillance, but a perfect control, where we feed back from this twin digital augmented reality thing back into physical reality. And so that's how AI can actually take control over where we live, right?
Well, and I think, you know, part of, you know, when people are looking at the technocracy, this idea of energy credits, right? You know, the Black Mirror episodes of inputs and outputs, like how much are you contributing versus how much are you sucking up and these different things. But once you have these blockchain systems and you start to have smart data analytics on what goes in and what comes out, both, And understanding that managing the function of biological processes are also going to start to be markets in eugenics, and that the GMOs are actually moving to a point of, like, you know, building vaccines or medical things into food systems, maybe getting to a point that's what I keep talking about, these passporting systems that folks talk about. guys, it's not going to be injections for very long. It's going to be part of like a larger geoengineering project or an edible market, like a biosensor. So don't adopt the language they give you, because that they give you that language for a reason. You have to cut to the chase. And ultimately, it's about, real-time bio data, like through, you know, the biosensors or the nanotechnologies that they have. But literally, you know, they can track, you know, a number of months ago, we came across, and you probably talked about it, the DNA nudge band that came out of Imperial College London. And people are like, well, I would never use, and they're linked to COVID testing, right? And so they're like, well, I would never do that, you know? And I'm like, it's not going to be a choice, because you're going to be on food stamps. And they're going to say the only way you can get your food, it's not going to be, oh, that's a nice, you know, value added thing for you that you have an option. It's that all of the people who are dispossessed and then made dependents on the state will have to get their food through a DNA nudge band, right? And that is the tracking. And then wait till they queue up the smart toilets. So then they get you at the other end and your biosensors, and then track you during the day in your smart shirt to see how productive you were, or your haptic suits. And it's that level of crunching. And as you said, that right now there is still somewhat of a human interface at some point down the line, but you know, they're talking about decentralized autonomous organizations, right? Like companies that run on computer code with no recourse of like, wait a minute. I think, can I contest that decision of my smart toilet? Like, you're not going to get that choice if it's a DAO. So, you know, all of the things, and I really wish that people who were more familiar with like the issues around, the prison industry could get up to speed on this, because they're turning the world into the prison planet. Like the prison reform, they're moving that model because they have the new model in place, which is a global incarceration model. Mm-hmm. And they don't need the ankle bracelets, right? They don't need that anymore. They have way more ways, even in your environment, the spatial web to track you in it. They don't actually need the bracelet anymore. And that's what people, I think, they're just not getting their head around yet.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, some people are starting to hear the fringe conversation around Internet of Things, connectivity, putting the supply chain in the blockchain. But that's a much more comfortable conversation than going from IoT to IOB, the Internet of Bodies, which, of course, the World Economic Forum is really hot on and goes into some of the bio-digital convergence you're talking about. You posted the other day to your blog, again, wrenchinthegears.com, the Canadian document that was entitled Exploring Bio-Digital Convergence. I'm going to read just a little quote because it speaks exactly what you're talking about. While I'm brushing my teeth, Jamie, my personal AI, asks if I'd like a delivery drone to pick up my daughter's baby tooth, which fell out 2 days ago. The epigenetic markers in children's teeth have to be analyzed and cataloged on our family genetic blockchain in order to qualify for the health rebate. So I need that done today. I replaced my smart sticker that monitors all my blood chemistry, dot, dot, dot. And also, I admit that it sounds kind of gross, but it's a really good thing that we finally have our smart sewers, the municipal sampling our fecal matter from the sewage pipes. It's part of the platform to analyze data on a nutritional diversity gut bacteria, there's that biome, and antibiotic use to aid with public health screening and fight antibiotic resistant strains of, you know, public safety. It's all about public safety. So you hear, I mean, this is them envisioning this perfect data awareness down to your children's teeth the day they fall out. Talk a little bit about the Internet of Bodies and where you see this going.
Well, so maybe I can say just a little bit about the social impact investing.
Yeah.
So in this premise, again, there's these two sections. It's all tied in with United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, right? Mm-hmm. Which sound good until you actually know what they're talking about. And 2/3 of those goals are actually about managing people in poverty. And then there's some over on the side that are about managing water and the climate and other things. But it's far fewer than you would think. It's mostly about managing people. And then also managing people in relation to the environment. So One Health is the World Bank's effort to essentially disconnect people from nature, to say it's for our protection and the protection of nature that we be totally separate, as opposed to living within, you know, interconnected ecosystems. And so this idea of impact investing is based on a predictive profiling deficit model that each person, even before they're born, based on crunching data about their parents or their where they live, will be a burden on society, will cost society a certain fixed amount. And that if you can have an intervention that's tied to a government contract that's outsourced to a nonprofit to fix you preemptively before you've even done anything, then that creates a narrow strip of return on investment for private investment companies. So this is the Goldman Sachs, this is the Vatican Bank, SoftBank, big insurance companies. a lot of them are going to be healthcare companies, and a lot of it is being framed as preventative healthcare, including food access. Okay, so the diabetes, mm-hmm. all of that. Diabetes is going to be totally weaponized, and that's why the lead-in to the last year's health situation hit so hard on chronic illness. So diabetes, heart disease, asthma, these chronic conditions that are going to be resolved through this Internet of Body sensors with these evidence-based interventions. Mm-hmm. So that is the impact market. So essentially what it does is allow permanent surveillance of targeted communities because they've got to get your data. It's like, you know, the AI is watching you as you brush your teeth. You don't get away from it. It pervades your entire life. And there's no incentive to ever make it right because their market, their bets, depend on the problem existing. And so you just grow poverty and trauma over time, okay? And when they talk about the tooth markers for epigenetics, it's actually a very deep eugenics element. And someone, when I, in December, we were doing an action and I was having a conversation and they said, and it was very telling, they said, you know, the crown interest, the royalty, you know, they're very into breeding, right? Animals. Dogs, horses, mm-hmm. you know, and so there is this deep eugenics, like optimization that is built into this, right? Plant societies, right? The fancy plants and the hybridization. And so they're going to use this epigenetic trauma within, you know, historical systems of oppression to feed these impact markets. And that's why they need the epigenetics. And it's really like biopiracy and data mining. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's all layered in together, and food is a huge part of it, because then they'll start to say, well, based on your epigenetics, this is what you have to eat.
Yep.
But the idea is that what's coming is a post-human world, really. So what is eugenics where the goal is a post-human world? In my mind, the goal of that level of eugenics is to create people as shells, as just shells of human beings that you can manage. It's not like the idealized, strong, virile person, you know, will do the, you know, work or fight the wars. No, you kind of just want a crippled person who will behave. And that is sort of where I'm at now in my thinking about both eugenics and epigenetic trauma and the food, is that they will design your food to make you into that.
Yeah, that's what Bertrand Russell told us, is it would be diet, injections, and injunctions that will conspire to create a worker class, right, that we can't do anything. I want to make sure we nailed just the basic idea of human capital finance there, because you said that there are going to be companies, you know, you also mentioned that hedge funds were somehow very involved in the education aspects up front. So people need to get that idea that they just turned water into futures, and now it's the financialization of everything, but now extending right into us, into our identity, into our social outcomes. If you do better in school than you were expected to do based on your genetic markers, then they say, well, it's because McDonald's put a play place right next to you and gave you play opportunities, and somehow, and then they get financially rewarded. So there's plenty we could say about just how ridiculous that is, and how any metric, once it becomes a target, ceases to be a useful metric, right? How they just game the system to make whatever outcomes it seems like. But is that a good basic like rundown of how to think of human capital finance?
Yeah, I didn't miss the hedge fund piece. So essentially what happens is that they predictably profile you against an existing cost, like prison, depression, diabetes. There's a cost, and the academic institution set that price. And then they do the difference between fixing you and what it would cost if you had a full-blown episode of either being incarcerated or, you know. But the money to be made isn't in that small return on investment, because most people would say, well, I don't really buy that you're going to make a lot of money in poverty, right? That just doesn't seem like, if you were going to go for a place to make money, that doesn't seem like a good buy, right? Like, why is Goldman Sachs getting into pre-K? But really, they're going to securitize the debt. The investors that are putting the money have plans to do all of the securitization on blockchain, actually. And then that's when the hedge funds will start to trade it, okay? And so there's already systems in place. New Jersey has a program called Career Impact Bonds, where they're using income sharing agreements. And so people who've been pushed out of work due to lockdowns are now being reskilled into big pharma, coding, alternative energy to do the fourth industrial revolution, but the income sharing agreements are going to be securitized. And surprise, surprise, Phil Murphy, the governor of New Jersey, is a 27-year Goldman Sachs executive, right? So there, it's all set up. And just as an example on how twisted this becomes, several years ago, Utah is a hotbed of a lot of this. It's both state intelligence and LDS and, you know, tech, University of Utah. And so a lot of the pilots are in Salt Lake City, and they had one for pre-K. And they gathered, they had a winter summit with Ian Galloway of the San Francisco Fed, because this is going through the central banking systems. And this panel was about youth recidivism, like juvenile delinquents, right? But the Q&A opened at the end, and there was a woman in the audience, and she said, you know, I'm listening to all of this. I work at a Salt Lake City food bank. And, you know, I know that none of these outcomes are going to be good if people are hungry, right? Mm-hmm. And none of you guys ever talk about hunger, which is goal number two, you know, of the UN Sustainable Development Goal number two is hunger. You never talk about hunger. And I don't get it, because none of your other programs are going to work if people are hungry. And so their response, like they sort of paused, and then Galloway said, well, you know, the thing about pay for success finance, which is what they call it, is that we need a cost offset, and we haven't figured out the cost offset for hunger. Okay, you're only going to feed people if you can find the appropriate cost offset. And this was maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And he said, maybe test scores. Maybe if we can tie feeding children to like their third grade test scores, that could be the cost offset. And what was so depressing was like the woman was just so grateful to have found a way to fit into the system, like for her program. Yeah. Yeah. She's like, okay, well, as long as I can get my stuff in the system, nobody in this room of ostensibly people, you know, which is a deeply faith-based community, mm-hmm. like had the temerity to raise their hand to the Federal Reserve and say, but wait a minute, like it's actually not like moral to condition children's access to food on a test score, people. And that's where this goes. And so all of the nice language, the way they talk about it, no one wants to peel back like, oh, hey, but the conversation when you actually unpack it looks like this, right? It looks like kids performing behaviors that the state or corporations decide are approved behaviors. And then increasingly they're trackable in this digital panopticon. Mm-hmm. And that children are being groomed from the age of 2 or 3 years old to accept that this is normal.
Exactly. And so you can call it a social credit score or a digital currency that's with behavioral controls. It's only going to allow you to purchase the things the system wants you to. You know, there's a number of different ways to language this, but that's the bottom line, is this is control over what people are doing. And so I appreciate you saying that.
I had a bit of a run-in. I just want to mention, like, because I didn't come at this from health, right? And so, like, clearly the health freedom, the wellness communities have very loud voices right now. And right now, there are a lot of people who are pointing fingers on the wellness side about people who they feel are not making good health choices, right? Like those people, because they feel attacked around, you know, the current health scenario, that those people are saying, well, why should you be afraid of me? I'm super healthy. And look at you, you're not doing good health behaviors, right? You're not eating right, or you're smoking, or doing these things. I'm like, that's exactly what they want us to do, is turn on one another, is not deal with structural problems around global supply chains and food access. And also policing other people's health choices. Like, none of us, in my opinion, should ultimately be policing other. We should give people access, make access affordable, support people in sharing information to give people the best options, especially children. But the policing of each other and the policing of behaviors is exactly what the impact investors want us to do, because that is the narrative where it's going, is let us tell you how to be healthy, and we're going to dictate it and track it on blockchain. Mm-hmm.
When you say, I've heard you say that food is central to this entire technocratic agenda. Can you just expound on that?
Well, so I read a book, Nick Estes, and it's called Our Past is the Future, Our History of the Future. I think it's about Standing Rock. It's about the Lakota. And essentially for me, because, you know, like I'm in Pennsylvania, Carlisle Indian School is here, right? And this idea of, destruction of families, cultural erasure, and taking people's food systems is to me like foundational. If we need to learn lessons, like to me, it feels like now we're at the ghost dance, you know, for all of humanity. And part of the way we accomplished this movement across the continent was to kill off the buffalo, to kill off the food sources. And then later, in the 20th century, even the Pick Sloan Dams, using public work systems to flood out bottomlands, to flood out places where people who had more subsistence or forage level types of access to the bounties of nature were pushed out of that, right? And so I feel like very strongly, while many people look to China or look to these other places, that actually we need to look closer to home, because this idea of cutting off food access to one's normal cultural food traditions, and I feel very strongly that this homogenization of a global diet or a vegan diet or a cricket is denying the cultural and the human aspect of one's food systems and trying to homogenize that, which is entirely the wrong thing. Yes. And then to control it, because what they did was they put people, they removed them off their land to a place that they did not have a relationship with those food, not just food, but medicines, right? Because they were using a lot of plant medicines and other things, and then gave them food rations that made them sick and gave them disease, and often didn't give them at all, right? And so to me, like, that is a profound lesson. And again, they did not fully accomplish this erasure. I mean, it was largely a genocidal process, but I do believe that there are lessons to be learned from that history in this moment, is that we have a larger reckoning with what does it mean to be in relation to your food system in a reciprocal arrangement, and how does one, you know, because I'm not vegetarian, right? And I have a lot of people who sort of point fingers, and I say, I would much prefer having a better food system, right? A regional food system, a system that is really sustainable, that is not about robots cutting up chickens and sending them halfway around the world and back, and the Dole fruit cups, all of that, right? But yes, that is a larger reckoning that I think requires us to have a broader understanding of the historical systems of how we relate to food, both from the original people to immigrants to this country to all the way forward up until, like, you know, the 50s, when manufactured food systems really kicked into high gear with the suburbs and everything. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And so how do you see food, access to food being used for most people? Like, how can they expect that to see that roll out?
I mean, I think a lot of us are already seeing it. I mean, I really don't do the mask thing. And so my spouse, like, has been going grocery shopping, and like, I actually had to go on Monday because we were out of town, and I hadn't been in a grocery store for like the better part of a year. And just the shelves are, you know, there's like a third of the shelf space that is empty. You know, it's very clear. And then most of the people who were in there were like shopping for online shopping, right? There were like not many. So, you know, I've seen this coming. We may have sort of different positionings on this. I see that there's two paths. I mean, there's certainly the importance of people being able to reclaim their food systems to the extent to which they're able to secure land or secure resources. But the other piece is, the more I understand about geoengineering, right, like weaponized weather systems, the nanotechnology, I don't know how sustainable that is to find some place when what we're realizing is that the prison planet is run by satellites, right? Like, if last year the Harvard Business Review was talking about macro eyes tracking African children from space to predict vaccine uptake, I don't know how realistic it is, unless you go hide in a cave, to make that happen. Which is, I'm not saying that there isn't, like, that it's not fulfilling to have a garden, right? Nourish your soul and to keep connected and to like have a community garden and be with that in and of itself is wonderful. But I just don't know what the long-term prospects are. So I think some of us have to contest it all the way down, because I don't think there's anywhere to run from this thing that's coming. So I don't know if that answers your question. Like, no, I don't know. Be fully prepared for this.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I think I saw that tweet where you said Ice Age Farmer is maybe too optimistic about this. I don't know. The nanotech is everywhere. You're not going to outrun it. So that's a good question.
Yeah, in the water cycle. I mean, that's the thing. Like, the National Nanotechnology Institute, like Penn, just got an NSF grant for biotech in the soil. Like, they don't, I mean, I'm sure they actually do know what they're doing, but it's terrifying because, like, I talk to people in the water department, which is very progressive. And I'm like, do you know about nanotech in the water? And they're like, no, we're still dealing with microplastics. And I'm like, think smaller. Yeah. It's going smaller. Like, once it's in the water cycle, what do you do? You know?
Yeah. Well, I did want to thank you for calling me optimistic. That's the first time I've heard Ice Age farmers is optimistic. But no. So the broader question. Okay. So yeah. So we can't outrun this nanotech and this ridiculous agenda. What do you do, Allison? What solutions do you see?
Well, all I can say, I think each person has to have their own reckoning with it. I mean, I've heard people recently say oh, I'm controlled opposition, or I'm telling people the wrong thing. I'm like, listen, guys, I'm not trying to lead anybody anywhere. I'm trying to figure stuff out and provide a narrative frame that I think does resonate with some people, doesn't resonate with other people. It's fine. You know, this isn't my livelihood. It feels like sort of a spiritual engagement, even though I'm not an organized religion person, but it feels like something bigger. Whatever I've stumbled into, I thought it was school closures, and it turns out it's like transhumanism, but okay, we'll go with that. And so Saturday I went up to New York, and they had the rallies or whatever around the world. And, I gave a speech on Foley Square, and it was the site of the African burial grounds. And actually it's interesting. So, that wasn't their former location. And when I looked at Google Maps, this was it. And I said, wow, that's we actually should acknowledge the ancestors in this. This is something quite significant, this location. And as a percent for art program in this park, they had a statue. Now, Foley Square is surrounded by all of these federal buildings, the Social Security, the IRS, the New York State Supreme Court, municipal buildings. It's kind of, now that we know totalitarian, it's quite a dominating set of architecture, around this, or the international trade courts, right? All in this space. And then in the center of the circle that's being rung by these buildings is an art installation. And his name was Lorenzo Pace, did this piece of artwork, and it was called The Triumph of the Human Spirit. And it was actually a granite ship that was meant to represent the Middle Passage, but on it was an abstracted figure called a chiwara, which is an African antelope. It's a headpiece normally for fertility and agriculture. And that was in the middle of the circle. And I said, that's it, guys. This is what we're fighting for. For the most part, people were there because they understood a relatively narrow subset of what was happening, right? Mm-hmm. They understood it as, and I don't mean to dismiss this. We need to grow this understanding, but they understood the medical passports or the controlling of people's movements. But I said, it's actually life. It is fertility, it is reproduction, it is agriculture, it is about all of that. And that is what we fight for, is in this space. And so, you've probably seen on my Twitter, I've had people sending me dandelions. I had this vision this spring, and the dandelions came to me. And I said, how do we feel like we have agency? Because for me, and I'm an older person, so I'm in my 50s. I don't want to fit in this thing. I would rather be the one who is peacefully saying, nope, I don't think this is it. This is not what we should do. Mm-hmm. For the people who can't. And so I said, send me dandelions, because symbolically, they're free. They're everywhere. They're on every continent. And they have the symbolism, right? And they're connected to medicinals, and they're edible. And so I've been having people send me dandelions from Switzerland, from, Idaho, from Vermont, and so we took them and we called out Wall Street. After this thing, we walked down, and people can see it on my YouTube channel. And it was just about 20 of us. But we had, we taught each other about what the hell was actually happening. And we intervened, trying to, energetically into the space with plant medicine, essentially, to say, no, there's something else. This is, whatever this profane thing that is, that you're trying to turn the world into a planetary computer, not about that. And so that might be just very naive. And I'm not trying to put down people who have more ambitious plans. I love my city. I don't want to run away because I think I would be bad at it, And actually in the Robopocalypse book, there's a book called Robot, which sounds terrible, but it's better than you would think. And in the end, when the robots took over, it was a pretty good book. They said all the people in New York who ran to the Catskills and didn't know what the hell they were doing, they did not fare very well. They said the people who stayed in New York and tipped over cars and made obstacle courses for the robots, because they knew their terrain, they did better. And so now I'm I don't actually want to give up the thing that I used to love about my city. I prefer to fight for it, which is not everybody's choice. I'm not saying everybody has to make the right same choice, but that's the choice I'm making for now anyway.
For sure. Yeah. And it's the right choice to fight. And that's the choice we all need to be making. I agree. It's going to take everyone, we all have unique voices. We come from different backgrounds and experiences. And so the way we do that, the way we engage this and try and spread the word is going to look different. And so I think the bottom line is as long as we're all doing everything we can. So we definitely have talked about food, and I've talked a lot about food. I would really like to invite you to talk a little bit more about education and the kids, like the play table that quantifies the way they interact with it, just to help give people some more insight into what's going on there, and to warn parents as well.
Yeah. Well, so I would encourage people, if they have time. So there's something called the Moonshot Project, or the Moonshot Goals, which is the Japan Science and Technology Agency. So the government of Japan, which is SoftBank and Nippon Telegraph and Telephone. And they're talking digital twinning, 6G, and they're saying, like, hey, by 2050, we're going to live outside of having a physical mind and body in time and space, right? Which sounds crazy, but I'm like, guys, like, and totally people have had pie-in-the-sky ideas about cybernetics for a very long time. Like, I'm not trying to be Chicken Little here, but I'm like, I think we should actually try to engage with this material and say it's not our preference. Like, we'd really rather not live as a cartoon character in a militarized video game, if we can help it. And we're not probably, like, I'm not going to be one of those people, but they want the children because they want to normalize that, right?
Absolutely.
And a lot of it is about behavioral nudging, digital nudges, and this game of human capital bonds is based on sort of setting people on pathways of self-improvement, right? Whether your pathway of self-improvement is around weight loss or physical activity or addiction treatment or workforce training or mental health, like, they're going to give you a task list and then check that you've, you know, done all of the things. And someone's betting that you do them and somebody's betting that you don't do them. And they want to condition children to that from these very earliest ages. So what we're going to see coming under the Biden presidency, which has been like long time in coming, and it's fully bipartisan, you know, and if anything, I think Trump was meant to inflame people to further make them partisan so we couldn't come together.
Yes.
That they want this children as human capital, because this is the generation that is going to live in the digital prison if they get what they want. Mm-hmm. And they would really like a lot of them, elementary and middle school kids, to be trained up to code the digital prison, especially the ones in Africa and India, who will do it at a cheap price. And so they've got these programs to pay for pre-K, right? Which sounds great, because we have an economic system now which is very hard to get by on one income family, right? One income household. You need multiple, two, three, four incomes to support people, you know, especially in urban areas. So, like, hey, affordable childcare is important. Well, the thing is, they want your kid from early ages. And I will say, as someone who is like recovering liberal and then left and now homeless, is like, the conservatives are right. They do want your kids. They really want your kids. And so Jim Heckman is this Nobel Prize winning economist at University of Chicago. So it's all the Chicago boys, right? And you will appreciate this, because they really look at humans as commodities. So it's the commodities futures market. And while in New York, we went to the stock exchange, I said, hey, it's not really the stock exchange, it's the commodities exchange that this is going to run. It's Chicago. So Heckman is funded by Soros and J.B. Pritzker, who's the governor of Illinois. And they're the ones who have been setting up blockchain, talking about putting SNAP food assistance on blockchain and coding it to make you buy the things that they want you to buy. And they said, okay, well, we've got this equation now. We can get a 7 to 10% rate of return on early childhood investments, or up to 13 if you get health data, right? So we're going to see like smart playgrounds, like who is it? Bechdel, the defense contractor. They're funding something called Playworks with rubrics for recess. Okay, so like when the militarized defense sector gets into recess, you know that there's a problem.
Right.
So they went all up and down to sell these bonds, because like, well, 7 to 10 isn't great, but it's pretty good for like a conservative thing. So they're going to throw all these kids on blockchain to get under the guise of getting them pre-K. And these programs have been set up in, like I said, Salt Lake City. Social Impact Bond was the first one. But how do you get the data? And what Heckman has said was like, we can't change cognitive data because IQ, if you believe in that, hardens up around the age 8 to 10. And it doesn't move for hedge funds, because really these aren't kids. It's data on a dashboard that represents a child. So they would say, well, you know what we can change? We can change character. We can change character. Essentially, they can digitally brainwash kids and track it and move the data on a dashboard around their character in terms of good behavior, and then take this credit, take the credit, the return on investment for this bet that they've made. Well, where do they get the data? Well, now they've developed things. Hatch Education has a We Play Smart Table. And this We Play Smart Table is sort of, if you picture a large screen TV parallel to the ground with two-dimensional puzzle pieces or things, and the children are supposed to play together. It's not a single game. They're supposed to interact because they want their social, emotional data. And there are cameras, fisheye lens cameras, two of them on either corner of the table to track and score the children as human capital, right? And the craziest thing is that they most want social emotional data. And I believe it is because they want to use that data to train the robots, which sounds crazy, but all of it is built on machine learning. And the more social emotional data that they can get, the more behavioral data they can get. A lot of these deals, like I was just talking about Cardano in Ethiopia, putting 5 million students on blockchain, they're partnered with Ben Goetzel and SingularityNet and OpenCog, which so Hanson Robotics, Sophia the Robot. I mean, they haven't straight up said it, but like they're also, UNICEF is all over Africa and India doing virtual reality education. They're going to put those things on those kids' headsets and suck their biometrics out and feed them to the robots. I mean, that is where this road goes if we don't refuse it. So, you know, it sounds ridiculous that I would even have to talk about this, right? It sounds perfectly ridiculous, but like I will even say Heckman had a whole conference, and this is interesting, at University of Chicago, oak panel room, all the people in the room, and one of the guys says, we can't get the parents to make the kids use the apps. This is like PBS Kids apps, like those Daniel the Tiger Tea Party. Don't put your kids on those apps. And he said, the parents say that they're going to do it, and they never do. And Heckman said, well, you know, he's like in his 70s. And he invited everyone there. And he said, you know, but they need, you're acting as if parents are experts. And they're not. You need to just gamify it for the parents, like a build a kid game. And but you need a good incentive. This is all behavioral economics. This is Sunstein and Thaler. A good incentive, like pornography. A good incentive, like. And then you could see everyone's heads sort of pivot and like kind of, did he just say that, right? And he's like, well, just kind of kidding about the pornography, but I mean, a good incentive, like really a good incentive. And so this is the headspace. Now, I will say Educare is the pre-K franchise Head Start kids. He was talking about the kids of Head Start parents in particular. They're being used in Tulsa. Tulsa is a test bed for a lot of this. It's the George Kaiser, who is the Bank of Oklahoma, big oil. He's backing Educare in Tulsa. That's where they have the surveillance play tables. The head of his foundation is Ken Levitt, who was the former advisor to George Tenet of the CIA. And this is the 100th anniversary of the race massacre in Tulsa last year. They've got the kids on surveillance play tables. So these historical systems of domination, like, thread through. And I think that's what I can bring to it because I come from, like, what is a landscape, right? Like, what is the history and where does this lay on the land? What is the geography and what are the layers? Like, let's peel back these layers because for the most part, I think people today are really trained to think in pretty narrow terms. That's why they get away with everything because no one thinks bigger. No one sees how it all connects.
Yeah, they're just...
microbiome. Can I say one more thing?
Absolutely.
Other thing is, if you go to, it's called the Human Capital Economic Opportunities Group at the University of Chicago, HCEO, James Heckman. He has a YouTube channel. I think I actually have more subscribers, which makes me feel better. But beyond the social emotional learning conference that he hosted, he had one on the microbiome. Okay. He had a whole one on that, like epigenetics and social justice of the microbiome, right? So these people, the same people who want to engineer your kids on the surveillance play tables, their brain, they're gonna manage your gut. They are totally gonna manage your gut and your brain, okay? And the other piece of this is, like, again, you know, gut brain health. There are issues around spectrum disorder, right? Like with the gut aspect. With a lot of this nanotech, biotech is also, it's the U.S., Israel, U.K. connections, you know, tech transfer. The IDF in Israel has a whole unit. There's the 8200 that everybody knows about, which has its own social impact accelerator. All of its alumni have their own social impact accelerator to use their tech. But they have the 990 unit, which is satellite systems like analysis. And they specifically recruit young people on the spectrum to do that work because they have a brain that can focus like that. like high functioning spectrum, because they have a focus to sit down and track the kids in Africa from space, right? And so if you understand this idea of engineering using one's gut, using one's eating food systems to engineer brain function to carry out the construction of this digital empire, like, I think that's where it's going.
It's like, let me just pause you 1 second, because I want to make sure, actually, the plug, you named a bunch of relationships and people there, and I wanted to mention that she's not just throwing these things out and enumerating them or making stuff up. There are, she's crafted these like mind maps is one word for them, these graphs of the connections and the people. Allison has a collection of these, which are amazing, and they're fantastic research, and they're worth checking out. And they are like isomorphic. They mirror the ones that I've done exploring the relationships between Rockefeller and the world. You know, it just looks exactly the same. The same people, the same players, the same funding for the food systems takeover. You can do the same thing for the COVID takeover. All the people who tried to rush out tests to farm workers first. It was the same companies aligning with Alphabet and Google and trying to get this stuff out there. There's another reason I knew we had to have this conversation, because our worlds, there's like 1,000 touch points for these conversations.
And then they disappeared on my maps. I mean, now they're in my blogs, and I have many of them on the Wayback Machine. But yeah. I mean, this it was through littlesys.org, which I urge caution. I mean, I have 4 years worth of crowdsourced data that I've added in there. But yeah, I mean, it shows you, once you actually see the relationships, how significant that is, that they just wipe them all, whoop, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but they're still in my blogs, and, you know, I have links in the Wayback Machine.
And they tell a very compelling story. And just, you know, some of the other stuff you threw out there was the singularity net. These are people that are constructing like a set of standards which functions as an API between different artificial intelligence agents. So you can have one AI that reaches out to other AIs, and it talks to each other and asks for help. So one AI can actually become like a domain expert of farm status and like soil moisture, and one AI would reach out to it when it needs the data. So companies, you can imagine companies, it's going to be like a competition of which AI is a domain expert for which thing, and then they're going to have these blockchain based currencies where they trade to do transactions to ask each other's expert systems little questions. It's an incredible AI ecosystem that they have, that they're building. It's not just imagine, they're building this now, working on that augmented reality. Go ahead. Yeah,
that's what they have to put it in, warehouses and freight containers, right? Like, I mean, soon local agriculture is going to be like a stack of freight container boxes in the Walmart parking lot, operated, run on phones. And my concern is, so now DuPont is working in the microbiome space as well, which is very concerning. Okay. And so if you imagine that, if you can grow, I put air quotes around food, in an hydroponic or an aeroponic environment, right, that is custom, maybe with the chemicals that you want in it, but that doesn't have any of its own natural microbiome. And I know you've talked a bit about the like tracking soils and, you know, the tracking through the global supply chains, not even needing the sensors anymore. But if you can create a blank slate of food matter that really doesn't have any nutrition in it, and then you overlay your nutraceutical, right? Like, here's your custom, like your AI, when you're brushing your teeth, your, you know, biosensor says, here's your, you know, 3D printed food goo, you know, according to what your most up-to-date, you know, sensor profile is. You know, it takes this whole idea of food as medicine, which I think a lot of people, again, in the wellness space think about, but they're not actually realizing that it's aiming to actually use the GMOs to bioengineer people.
Yes. It's Hippocrates, let thy food be thy medicine. No, we're talking about it was GMO vaccine, edible vaccines. The Russians had an edible COVID-19 vaccine that they talked about. And this is, you know, when the Rockefeller Foundation Reset the Table doc comes out and it says we want a health outcome based food system that's going to be sustainable and equitable. We're going to expand SNAP benefits through the roof, which is talking about this other weaponizing social assistance programs. And we're going to have food as medicine. It was one of the biggest bullet points in that whole agenda. And it doesn't make sense. That's why we have to have this conversation, because it doesn't make sense if you just talk about, well, it sounds like they want healthier food. No. This is once you start looking at the rest of these people and the conversations that are happening, you see that these are all the words they're using and the agendas and the architecture that they're building all hooks together. And it is this perfect prison, as you've described it. Yeah.
Can I say something about another story about UNICEF?
Sure.
So I don't know how long we have. Do we have? Oops. Oh gosh, I'm realizing my light is not great. Just a second here. I will. Let me just do this. The sun is shining on me. Sorry.
It's all right. You got the Empire Strikes Back, Turn to the Dark Side, kind of a.
Okay. All right. This is better. I didn't see myself in here. So anyway, so when I was just doing school stuff, and this is how things thread together, right? Because especially if you expand the school day, right, and you expand the school year, the school system start to control a lot of food access for children.
Yes. Yes.
And I would say, as someone who is in an urban school district with many of the schools that are old buildings, they actually weren't built with kitchen facilities, okay? So these were schools that were built when kids went home for lunch and then came back. So what I saw as a parent would be that kids who got lunch in schools, it was all prefabricated, it was in plastic, it was microwaved, it was not good quality. It wasn't homemade, like it was not really good food, right? It was barely passable as food. But you can, and a lot of this is commodities, the Walmarts, if you get after school programs, they start throwing off the stuff that's like not that great and like just give it to the poor kids at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And so you expand that. But so a friend who is a second grade teacher in Maine, she said her co-teacher, and this was maybe 4 years ago, and she had a blog called Saving Maine Schools. Her co-teacher brought in a program with Fitbits for the kids, and it was tied to UNICEF. And it was wearables for good, okay? And this was like a UNICEF program. And the kids were supposed to show a certain amount of step counts or fitness. And then if they did, then a food packet would be sent to a child in need somewhere in the global south. And these wearables actually, with UNICEF, started to be branded by George Lucas and Star Wars and Target. And so there are these systems when we talk about the internet of bodies, like that is the internet of bodies, right? So you're actually double dipping because you get an impact metric for the kids' health outcomes in Maine. And then you have like a hunger impact on, you know, the humanitarian aid in Africa. And you're double dipping on the impact data, right? And so, you know, and what she said is like, you know, this is a 7-year-old comes up and they were like, but if they have the food, why don't they just give it to the kids?
Wow.
Like, why don't they? And like, yes, the wisdom of the 7-year-old, if they have the food.
From the mouths of babes. Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, that's what we're up against. And everyone thinks that they're doing right, right? That they're doing right. And many of these systems are coming out of the aid space, but they're boomeranging back into domestic poor populations. Mm-hmm. And I will say a lot of it, so goal 2 is hunger, goal 3 is health, the health impacts, and they interface, and Michael Bloomberg is connected to a lot of this. He was the one who was putting the calorie counts, right? Because he was the UN ambassador for climate change and the World Health Organization. He was running the New York City police state rollout with Microsoft. You know, it is totally the nanny state, right? It is your government run by Google and Goldman Sachs. And no one quite understood where it was going when they just wanted to put the calorie counts. But this is where it goes. It goes to the DNA nudge band at this next phase, you know, and then down to your biosensors. But they want to do something called social prescribing. And I will say there are things that sound nice if you don't know the seamy underbelly of it. So they will say things like, let me write you a prescription for nature. Doesn't that sound nice? It's a non-pharmaceutical intervention. It's so nice. We'll go on a hike. Why don't you go on a hike? Why don't you go volunteer, right? And there's a whole program in D.C., and I made a map of this called Produce RX. Oh, let me write you a prescription for some kale, right? And so that's the way in which things that seem like, yeah, totally. Like if you were to go, like have a chance to do yoga in the park or kayak or, you know, learn some new, you know, Ayurvedic cooking or something, and it wasn't on the blockchain, it wasn't in the cool, good for you, right? Good for you. You know, I'm in a botanic garden. I said it will be very different if they put a QR code on our sign and somehow we become an affiliate of a managed health system.
Yep.
And then they start saying, well, you know, if you really want to get your diabetic socks, for, you know, a refresh on that after 6 months, you better show that you showed up to the, you fulfilled your prescription for nature, mm-hmm. right? You better show that you ate all the right things. And so like disentangling both like policing people's health choices and health behaviors with providing access and support. It's very different things. It's very different things.
And well, we don't like to call it policing. It's incentivizing, right? We're trying to help people. Magic.
Oh, nudge. You know, it's just a gentle nudge. And that's all that Chicago stuff, you know, choice architecture.
So, yeah, I hope people got that. If you didn't eat on 3 days out of every week, if you didn't have one of our approved meals, if you didn't visit one of your four approved, you know, music or garden, maybe you have some choice, but it's from this prescribed list from your insurance company, then you don't get your benefits. And it's the same for all social programs. This is their...
That's what Medicare for All is. That's what it is. Yeah. And I keep saying, like, why are people in the health space who are making this advocacy not talking about blockchain electronic health records? Because that came straight out of Zeke Emanuel, right? Like, that's the guy who's like, well, I think maybe after 72, you know, your time is up, right? That's the guy who's like the ACA architect, you know, whose brother, you know, is Rahm and Ari is doing the entertainment, and they've got a lock on all of this. This is a commodities center. This guy's coming. He's out of Penn, right? He's a bioethicist. But, like, we think maybe your time is going to be up at some point. We'll just pull the plug on you. So these electronic health records that are sold as a convenience, your SNAP is going to be feeding into your electronic health record. Your step counts are going to be feeding into your electronic health record. You know, early in all of this, there was an article, an op-ed in Australia called Walk for the Dole. Well, you know, everybody's sitting around in their house getting a little pudgy. You know, if you want your food stamps, you better demonstrate that you're walking. And, you know, and then Boris Johnson's like, yeah, I'm getting a little pudgy. Maybe I should do some walking too. And that's how these things get woven in. And so, like, all of the people who are advocating for single-payer healthcare are not connecting evidence, or they call it value-based payments, the Internet of Bodies, which, just look up, RAND has a report called The Internet of Bodies, Risks and Opportunities. Mm-hmm. And the guy who 100% funded this report, this white paper, he was the former chair of Swiss Reinsurance. These are the derivatives people. These are the actuaries who are running this game, who are betting for you or against you, you know? And so we are the supply chain. I mean, I know we had talked a bit about that, these global supply chains, right? But most people are not connecting that now our behavioral compliance is a key part of the supply chain. We are being processed. We are like the chickens being deboned, you know, on the assembly line. Only the deboning is, are you behaving according to these goals that global finance has set? And any one of these goals, if it wasn't in the panopticon, if it wasn't tracked, if it was your choice, might not be a bad thing. I like riding a bike. I like eating kale. I like these things, right?
Yes.
Very different if it's like Goldman Sachs is betting on how, if I went up the hill on my bike ride home or not.
Yes. Very different. And you're naming some of these players. It's the same. You know, you look at the World Economic Forum's tracks for control of water, and it's Nestle, Unilever, Pepsi. You know, the company. These are the companies who are deboning it, as you put it, humanity, the different parts of your behavioral profiles, and then placing bets on that, trying to find financial incentives. It's just insane. It was a great way of explaining that. I'm still trying to figure out what social justice has to do with my gut biome. And so you mentioned, actually, was it a social injection? One thing that I have seen was that this new, it's not a pandemic, it's a syndemic. It's this synthesis of social conditions and behaviors and things that we need to solve. And we need a social vaccine, which is a combination of equitable outcomes. And, you know, it's just it's an astounding use of language, perversion really of language. Is that the same sort of social injection that you were referencing?
Well, there's a couple of things. What I have seen a lot is called social determinants of health.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so and again, if you peel back the history on public health, as I'm sure you do, to the Rockefellers, like, it's not the nice thing that you think it is. Like, I think most of us, until you look into the history of it, think, oh, public health is for the public good because we care about people being healthy, and that isn't actually what it's ever been about.
Mm-hmm.
So the social determinants of health is looking at the ways in which, you know, people's environments, the circumstances in which they live, the behavior of the people around them impact their health outcomes, right? But the reality is that they have no interest in fixing the environmental. Their goal is, through the behaviorism, is to put the responsibility on the individual to behave properly, as though there was not a structure to the problems in which they exist. So the garden where I'm at is in the middle of, historically, it's opposite refineries. okay, like Philadelphia was one of the first refineries because oil was in Titusville. It's a center of trash transfers. We have one of the upriver, one of the oldest trash compaction oil like things from the 20s. It's like a historic monument to trash compaction. You know, we have the recycling centers that are like waste management in the mob, you know. And so it's like this very high, and giant electrical towers running through, right? And so these people, this part of the city that we're in, giant scrapyards, right? It's so sad because the parking lot, it used to be for Yellowbird school buses, like for the city school buses. And now there are no more school buses. And so it's just a scrapyard with torn apart cars. And there's houses opposite that. There's little row houses, modest row homes. People are living in this environment that's making them sick. And yet, no one is going to come in and say, here, you know what, let me get rid of this scrapyard and put in like a nice park and some, give you guys community gardens. And no, they're going to say, here's your brainwave monitor. Like, here's your step count thing. Here's your DNA nudge band. Like, you better perform. Even though now we're installing all these 5G small cells that the frequency is going to like, very likely lead to increased diabetics. You know, if you look at electronics, we're going to slap electronics on you that might make you pre-diabetic, but then we're going to test that you've behaved according to our rules. And so that's the thing that is so frustrating, is that if you actually believe that Goldman Sachs cared, you know, that it wasn't just a money laundering thing through children. I mean, in the deal that they did on Salt Lake City, this pre-K social impact bond, they gave pre-K to 100 kids that were screened into the program, and the cost offset was special education at kindergarten, okay? So they gave them a year or two of pre-K. Of the 100 kids, only one of them got special education. And they said that's outrageous because that would never work. Like, that those numbers don't add up. So either you're screening kids in that wouldn't have needed it, or right, you're depriving kids of services, or both, right? Yeah. Or both. And so they control the game. And, yeah, you know, and I've done, you know, some talks, like, it's their game. We're in this game. Kevin Werbach of Wharton, who is a gamification and a blockchain expert, says, you know, you want to be the one designing the game, because half the people don't even know they're in the game.
Yes.
And like another 30% of the people don't really know the rules of the game, or they don't know all the rules of the game. There's only a small number of people who actually know that there's a game and what the rules are. Mm-hmm. So you want to be the game designer. And that's what the Michael Bloomberg, the data analysts, the people who are being groomed for this prison planet, running this prison planet, are doing. And, you know, I'm the parent of a college-age student who, you don't want your kid to win or get the brass ring and get to be the overlord. I mean, I don't, like, because that's a soul-killing thing. Mm-hmm. Like, who's going to get to write the plays and actually farm the land and, you know, take care of people if the robots are doing it all? Nobody. So we have to fight for our right to do that and be in relationship both to one another and to the land and to the ecosystems. Because what I always say is, I'm also fighting for the bees. Like, these stupid robo bee people at, you know, Harvard, the WIST, whatever institute, they're going to kill all the pollinators. You know, I actually talked to somebody in the wellness space about 5 and 6G. I'm like, how can you be wellness and be all about the 5G and the blockchain? And they're like, well, like, maybe we'll have clothes we can wear outside. It'll be fine. I'm like, what about the bees? You know, then we're going to have to eat microgreens out of, you know, cargo containers.
Well, we'll have some nanobots for fertilization services, as they call it, right?
I know. So.
Yeah. Okay, so you're exactly right. I just want to explain a little bit more, because I've talked in the past about how this designing the gamification thing, it means they make the rules. It means physical reality and like life as we've known it no longer is the case. It's just whatever rules the technocrats impose upon us. And the way you describe that is flawless. They are viewing these problems that mostly that they have created through this very narrow lens that allows them to put arbitrary parameters on it and then define weird goals that only drive your behavior, that only drive your compliance. It has nothing to do with making you better. It has nothing to do with even physical reality. It's just, you know, I've used, because I talk about food, I've used the example of the University of Sheffield study that says sheep farmers could make more money if they stopped farming sheep, right? If they just stopped doing that, and we'll pay them carbon offsets, and they'd actually make more profit. It makes no economic sense. There's nothing being produced, but money's being, you know, given here. But that's an example of the way that when a technocratic government. Like when the state can come in and just impose arbitrary rules and incentives and change the structure of things, then they can drive behavior in weird ways that don't make fundamentally that don't make real sense. What else, Allison, should I have asked today? What else would be a good question here?
I mean, I think we covered a lot of ground. I mean, I think we need to look out for the children, you know, mm-hmm. and we need to, I mean, more and more people are going to be pushed onto government dependency. You know, that's where it's going. So I think really understanding the ways in which many of those systems have been stacked against people for a long time. And I would also say that because of this stuff that's going on with blockchain now, these human capital bonds, the pay for success projects, it's technically you still need some government money, right? The government pays if it's deemed to work, like if a chronic illness program works or a recidivism program works or but that can't last very long, right? Because essentially the rich don't pay taxes. And if the poor are all pushed onto UBI, there's really no government funding at that point, right? And so what the financiers have come up with, I believe, and again, it's unclear if they will be able to do all of the things that they're saying, all these thought ideas, but they have pilots. There's something called an impact security. So that it's a company called NPX, N as in Nancy, P as in Paul, X as in xylophone, NPX Impact Security. One of the people's out of Wharton. So we just bake up all of this stuff in Philadelphia. And what they said was it's essentially a new debt finance vehicle where there's no government involved. Okay, so nonprofits can issue debt and investors can invest in it, and there's a pay for performance component. And then if they hit their target, a foundation pays it back. And so if we understand that most of this is being run by fintech, right, the concept, and pharma, mm-hmm. And they have both sides, right? You've got Gates and the Gates Foundation. You have Dell and the Dell Foundation. You have the Hewlett-Packard, William Floyd Hewlett-Packard Foundation. They own both sides. So the people who are trapped in the middle giving the data to show that they've complied with the program to get the impact data are just batteries for the system of money laundering and bet making. And so I think that's really important. The other thing that I would say, so the piece of this is blockchain. So there's no government at that point, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even though the government is really corrupted, like, at least there's some sense maybe out there that you could still maybe change things. This is trapping people in a fully unaccountable system.
Yes.
That is where the libertarian stuff goes. And this is where I'm trying to, like, tap into people who are more libertarian, like, constitutional-minded, is that this augmented reality thing that is being rolled out that is fundamentally a militarized structure is what it runs blockchain. It's called the spatial web. That is the prison planet, right? And so that prison planet structure, that augmented reality structure, is meant so that people, individuals, high wealth individuals, can invest in whatever they want across the world, right? Mm-hmm. They can invest in wells, they can invest in farms, they can invest in toddlers, they can invest in people in addiction, they can invest in, you know, overweight people. They can just put their money, and it's only accountable to the contract, right? It's only accountable to whatever contract that is made. And the people who are being managed under the terms of that contract may not have a choice. They may be pushed into those services because they have no other choice. They have no other economic options other than to be managed for workforce development, training, food, whatever. Like, they're going to be pushed into that. So even if this idea of, like, the bad government, which I agree with, it doesn't necessarily resolve on blockchain if you, create global investment markets in poverty. And then it's just a free-for-all with Peter Thiel and Piero Mediar and, you know, these folks in the Vatican investing you. And many of them, I believe, will be faith-based institutions, all kinds. And then what happens if you got trapped in a service provider that is running behavioral compliance on blockchain tied to a certain faith practice that isn't yours? And so I guess that's the other piece of this that I want to balance, because I'm trying to, like, I tweeted today, like, there's a white paper from an Idaho libertarian leaning group that was saying, like, hey, get the government out of our business. Like, look, our churches can invest in our people. Mm-hmm. And I've been going to, like, you know, I talk to people in Israel, I talk to people in Salt Lake City, and I'm like, listen, if you're a person of faith, like, you have to really get a handle on what this is, that this is surveillance play tables and DNA nudge bands. And is that actually a charitable enterprise? Because my gut is still that most people are good. The institutions may be totally corrupted, but I believe that most people are good if they knew, if they mm-hmm. had the information, that they would make a better choice.
Yes.
And so this is the piece that I'm trying to sort of spin out. And then within that, the other thing I will say is the impact investors are after cooperatives or after worker cooperatives too. And that has deep connections to agricultural spaces, because one of the impacts will be worker productivity or happiness or something like that. And they'll say, look, workers who are part of cooperatives are much better. Like, they feel much better about their work. So these impact investors have been making their way in very specific ways into the cooperative movement. And yeah. So again, you probably know more about that than me, but I can see in the agricultural spaces that that is going to be important to know.
Yeah, there's a ton of stuff around farm worker protections and just creating a new class of people there that needs protection. One other thing I was hoping you could speak to, actually, because we mentioned the companies that don't have people that don't have management. And I think that's similar to the state that isn't a government anymore. It's just now we have this, you know, we got to be careful because we're years away. We're walking now into this, to the future where there aren't people to appeal to. There's just these algorithms that run and they have AIs talking to each other and this singularity net. But the idea of the gig economy and waking up and you just check your AI to figure out which DAO boss you report to that day.
Yeah,
can you flesh that out a little bit? Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, that's part of the education piece, is that I think many people in the blockchain space are imagining it mostly as like, crypto is financial assets, right? But it's a ledger system to track everything, really.
Yep,
it's tokens.
Exactly.
Rights and privileges. And this is what I need, like, the constitutionalist people to understand, is like, you're never getting down to the Constitution. The tokens that are in your wallet for your behavioral compliance are going to decide what you get to do and not get to do. And you don't, those human rights, those constitutional rights, you're not getting there, because the militarized augmented reality is going to be that buffer to get to keep you away from that, unless we do otherwise, right? Unless they wake up and do otherwise. So in the education space, and this is where I actually thought the digital identity, so the these medical passporting systems, which I kind of call like, you know, biometric geofencing, right? Because it really is like the prison planet run from space, and borders are going to change. And the idea mm-hmm. of immigration issues is going to really morph, and people are not up to speed on that. But like, mm-hmm. Your biometric data can create a real-time border around you anywhere you want. So they're getting rid of national borders, you know, and replacing them with real-time geofencing. And I'm not a nationalist, and I think that we need global solidarity, because, like, in this world of competing for AI gig work, we don't want something where the kids, you know, in Ohio are competing against the kids in Boa Vista, Brazil, or competing against, you know, the kids in Foshan, China, to do low-wage piece rate work for a day or two and then move on to the next thing. Like, we should want a world where all the kids actually get a decent quality of life. And so mm-hmm. we're not each other's enemies. The enemies are the people who are running the prison planet. And like, yeah. I just want to make that clear. So I had thought that the AI is going to assign work, and whether this is a decentralized autonomous organization like a DAO, like a company written in code, on a leaderboard, which is already in place in a lot of the coding world, people who are doing, remote work, you know, you log in even the MTurk work, you know, the Amazon, you know, work, coding work, that's been going on for a really long time, like mm-hmm. in certain segments. But most people, if you're not doing it, you don't even know that that economy exists. So, you know, you it's not even that you log in. I sort of imagined it as QR codes are just not like health codes. Right. You imagine like all the health codes, but now it's work codes. You need to have these 200 codes to apply for this work. Right. And your whole life is you're chasing the next skill code to try to get the work. But there's always like 200 people competing for the work. So you go into debt to do this stupid online class to get the badge to show that you can compete for the work. And then they say, oh, no, now you need this badge. Right. You need this badge. And it all goes on to blockchain. It's in your online learning locker. So I had thought when all of this stuff came before last March, that it was going, that blockchain digital identity, which sometimes they call self-sovereign identity, and that's the ID 2020, would come through, in the United States at least, through the education credential space. Mm-hmm. So MIT had something called Learning Machine, and they were doing digital transcripts. And they were, look how convenient it is. You have your college transcript on your phone, which is ridiculous because, like, you don't need your college transcript on your phone unless you're moving into this new phase of globalized gig labor. Yeah. But that was being sold through Southern New Hampshire University, and then it was having pilots in Dallas, which is green light credentials, and Learning Machine was in Tulsa. So these same this. And, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase was backing it. It was community college. Look, in high school, you can get an associate's degree when you're 17 and be all done with school. And then you can just track your micro-credentials. These are all going on blockchain, and it's all for the identification. But what they most want, they want your behavioral data. Because it's all about trust, and that's the code word for blockchain is trust. How is the AI going to know they can trust you to do the work if they don't also have your behavioral data on record, right? And that is exactly what, if you listen to the clip I pulled from Hoskinson about Cardano in Ethiopia, is they've said, hey, like our new education program on blockchain is totally aligned to the government interests, and your metadata from the time you're like a young child will be tracked, and we will know if you're a good actor in the space. And we will be able to tell who is qualified, who is almost like morally allowed to have a job. Mm-hmm. And he just says it in a 2-minute clip. Like I didn't even have to, he just says straight up, this is the plan. Blockchain metadata will decide this. So, you know, and it's not just in China, right? This is Ethiopia now. And Hoskinson is based out of Colorado. So, mm-hmm. you know, that's Colorado, Hong Kong, Edinburgh. This stuff is spread everywhere. It's globalization. Yep. And it's called Globalization 4.0. And I encourage people to look into it because it's not just screen-based now, it's haptic robotics. It's like, here, put on your haptic suit and your augmented reality headset and run, and you're going to be doing factory operations. Like, maybe you're going to be doing chicken processing, but the chicken processing plant is, you know, 5 countries over. Mm-hmm. You know, and people can't even imagine that that's something that's coming, but it is coming. And, you know, I don't know where all the anti-globalization folks are. I mean, to me, that is the central premise. And not coming from a nationalist, like, I don't like other countries, but that we actually need to respect our local systems, right? Our local foodways, our local, you know, that's real sustainability, right? Is to be situated in a space and have a sustainable quality of life using the resources that are in a relatively proximate place to you, which may involve relearning how we eat, right? But not in a way that's a 3D printer, DuPont's giving you your bio nutraceutical, but actually what grows where you are. And like, let's stop the geoengineering already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's better than showing up to the Global Mechanical Turk in exchange for your Soylent Green for the day. That's a really staggering conversation, and I've genuinely enjoyed walking through the technocratic landscape with you. I think we've thrown out a lot of the terms and ideas that might be new for a lot of people, so that they can go and look more into them, watch more of your stuff, and just actually go see. Please, by all means, don't take our word for it. Go look at any of the names we've talked about today. These are public policy documents. They do shroud it in these weird philanthropic-sounding terms, but you know, these are words that we need to have so that we can normalize them and make sure other people are aware of these agendas going on. There's one more question that I ask all my guests, but I think particularly in light of just how dark some of this future kind of seems like it will be, I wanted to ask you, and that is, you know, if you stare too long into the abyss, you risk becoming the abyss. So what do you do for self-care? How do you unplug from this? How do you take care of yourself?
Well, like I said, this Dandelion project has been pretty amazing. Like, yeah. I mean, it's, and again, like I'm trying to, one of the things we read at the Wall Street Bowl, and actually it's really interesting because there, I don't know if you remember a number of years ago, there was this fearless girl statue, and they put the girl statue in front of the Wall Street Bowl, and they're like, oh, look, it's women's rights, which is really another Sustainable Development Goal 5, which is gender equity. And it was put there by a global investment firm, State Studio, you know, but we were deconstructing the bull. Actually, I had a friend do a strategic application of some dandelion tincture on the working end of that bull, which was pretty interesting. But, you know, we had some levity around it, and we were talking about, we didn't want to stand in line to wait for the head end of the bull, so we just worked on the what was available. That was being very capitalist to wait in line to put our garland, our medicinal garland around the head of the bull. So we cobbled its foot. But we are reading out of A Wrinkle in Time, which is a book like from the 70s I read as a kid in elementary school. And it was sort of like love wins. In the end, it's this loving thing. And so I think right now, We went to go make this garland in a city college. I have a friend, and she's like, I know where there's a ton of dandelions on the campus of City College, which is really important because all these crazy equations were put together in the Harlem Children's Zone, right? So I'm like, we're going to get these plants from, and we went up, and all of the dandelions had gone to seed and blown away. So it was all these stems that were like this big. I'm like, oh, well, now what do we do? So we put mugwort, and we had plantain, and we had Star of Bethlehem, and we like wove this thing together, and they were all medicinals. And it was this creative act, right? And it was like also serendipity, because like we kind of had a plan, but we did it with people. And these are people I did not know before. And you know, and I've had people like I put my address. I have, if you look up Dandelion Manifesto on Wrenching the Gears, you can mail me dandelions, right? And someone's like, well, you shouldn't put your address on there. It's very dangerous. I'm like, you know, like they can find me if they want. But, you know, I've gotten so many, like somebody sent me this beautiful necklace, like, and somebody sent me dandelion honey from Georgia, and people have sent me things, like, and people want to have this connection, right? Mm-hmm. And so I feel like even in the resistance movement right now, there's a lot of bitterness, right? Like people have hit this plateau of being really angry and out of control. And I'm like, you know, this is, it's a psychic, like it's a spiritual thing. And like, we have to work really hard to find the loving parts, right? Like if you risk and you put stuff out, and the other people who are willing to risk also put themselves out, and then you find these amazing things. Like I have learned way more in the past year plus months. I would have a way more, like this is not the midlife crisis I expected, but like, it's like a gift. Like people have given me these gifts. And you know, I talk about like the gift economy. It's the not blockchain economy, right? You put things out in the world, you use your gifts, like my gifts are making these stupid maps and talking on interviews or whatever, and then people give you their gifts. Mm-hmm. And nobody's tracking it, nobody's counting, tabulating. It's just, there's beauty in it. Like there's this beauty. And you know, we were actually standing at the base of the Washington statue in front of Federal Hall, which is where he signed that was inaugurated in the Northwest Passage and whatever. And someone had gifted me this beautiful box of shells and dandelions from Lake Onondaga upstate. And I've sprinkled the shells on Washington's shoe. And I said, you know, we shouldn't have done that. You land speculator, you know, next to the Trump building. I'm like, no, like, you know, and then we're scrubbing the base of the statue. And this guy walks up and he has a gorilla mask on. And I'm like, oh, New York, this is really New York. Like, it's like these steps in this plinth with the statue and this gorilla mask, and he's watching us. And we're like, we refuse the human capital bond market. We refuse putting children on blockchain. And we, you know, refuse the New World Order. And the guy with the gorilla mask is watching us. And I kind of put out on Twitter, I was like, this is, like, go figure, right? Like, what is this thing? And someone said, that's Hanuman or whatever, which is, like, this monkey god who, like, protects the people who tell the truth. And I'm like, okay, so maybe this guy just showed up with some other thing. But I'm going with it. There's somebody out there protecting people who tell the truth. And that's nice. You. And that's me. And we do the best we can, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we have
one. Yes, the one thing the AI, I'm sure that drives the AI crazy, because as long as we come from here, they might be able to model us and predict us. But when we come and we shift to the heart, like you said, yeah. Move to that loving space that is not their domain, that is where we still own it. The digital space, it's all theirs. Physical reality, they are intruding into. But this... this is ours, and that's where we need to shift back to. Allison, again, thank you so much. Wrenchinthegears.com. How can people support you and help you and find you?
Well, I would just say, like, check out my blog. I still have a YouTube channel, just my name, Allison McDowell. I'm on Twitter, Philly8x2, and look me up. Send me some dandelions. We're gonna hit up Rockefeller Foundation, Common Past Project. We're thinking about a solstice celebration actually out on Roosevelt Island, which is where a bunch of the folks from Common Past are from. So we're thinking about a celebration of natural life. If you're in the greater New York area, June 20th, we're still putting it together. Follow me on Twitter. We'll figure it out. But let's do it for each other, right? And not just humans, also the other little critters, you know, the bees and the moss and all of the, because that is the natural connection. That is the not planetary computer part.
Beautiful. Allison McDowell, thank you so much.
All right, thanks.